Welcome back to Air Quality Matters and part two of my conversation with Henry Burridge. Out of interest, what are the monitors that you're using in SAMI recording? What are the indoor air quality parameters that are being recorded?
So indoor air quality, we record carbon dioxide levels, PM levels, particulate matter levels, and then TVOC, total volatile organic compounds. And then in terms of sort of environmental factors, we also record temperature and humidity.
We haven't really talked about particulate matter. That increasingly is going up the scale of interest in all sorts of environments. Are you seeing some interesting data from a particulate matter perspective in classrooms?
I think the answer is yes. Scientifically, we're at the early stages of data gathering, really. But we're already able to see interesting things. For example, we've just written a short sort of technical report to provide some information to schools based on what we're able to see, because they obviously see the data from their one monitor. They don't get to see the data from all the other monitors. But because we've got this big network of monitors out there, there was a Saharan dust event which originated from the Sahara, happened in early September, more or less as UK schools were, well, English schools were going back. Of course, the Scots go back a lot earlier. And what we were able to do is get outdoor air quality data and look for the spikes in PM levels outside, and then look at those indoors. And there was an amazing correlation. We could actually analyze the data in a way that we could see that the indoor and outdoor air were best correlated when you put in an offset of about 3 hours. So what was happening outdoors seems like the levels took a few hours to see those peaks indoors. But these are the sorts of things you can do with particulate matter. What's the reason that people are so interested in particulate matter? So, you know, ambient PM, outdoor PM, that is, has probably the best established links to health effects of any air quality metric. The trouble is, you know, I always say this to my student, why are we measuring, you know, let's say, why is SAMI measuring those three things? It's one, because they're interesting metrics. It's two, because we can. We have sensors that are relatively affordable that can measure particulates with a suitable accuracy. And so we know that not all PM is the same. You know, trees and other vegetations give off a lot of particulate matter. Is that the same as you know, brake dust that's being generated as people drive their cars around cities? Is it the same as the emissions from, you know, combustion, either in cars or you know, our cookers even? The health effects, it's nonsensical to suggest that they're all identical. So far, the best data that we have cannot distinguish between the effects of different types of PM and identify that difference. So where we are at the moment is we're sort of enslaved in some sense to having to think as all PM as being the same. And that may be in part because we focused on outdoors. I'd love to see studies that investigated the health effects of indoor PMs separate to outdoors somehow. I don't know how we're going to do this scientifically, but, you know, is a PM concentration of, you know, 10 micrograms per cubic meter indoors, does it have the same level of implication as 10 micrograms per cubic meter outdoors? We don't know the answer to that.
And that's a really good point. And arguably, we could say that about so many pollutants. You know, TVOCs, for example, are measuring the total amount of chemicals we see in the space. If that same TVOC sensor was outside, it could have exactly the same number, but be measuring totally different organic chemicals, so compounds. So it's one of these things, isn't it? Is that there's so much more to learn. We know these things are impactful on our health. I think that at this stage is fairly unquestionable. The key is understanding why and breaking that apart. And I think you said something to me the last time we spoke, which I took away with me, which was describing PMs is a bit like describing animals. As a PM being a canine, where in fact a PM is really all mammals. So we kind of got to start breaking apart this description of some of these pollutants into more meaningful ways. If the control mechanisms for it beyond the engineering controls that we can apply are based on source control, we need to start understanding where the sources of these PMs are coming from, don't we?
We absolutely do. Yeah, and that's a lovely quote that I'm going to forget the reference of now, that about PMs being like all mammals rather than a single species. It's just obviously true. And it's almost worse, really, if you start looking at TVOCs. The sensors work in a subtly different way. So they are more or less sensitive to different species of VOC. So even the total number is almost certainly always wrong. There's a lot of work to be done. But I think your point about the importance of it being highlighted by the right solution, which is source control, is a really good one. And it's a really strong motivation, I think, to do these sorts of investigations to evidence what within the PM and what, if anything, within the TVOCs we're measuring is really harming our health. You know, for example, lots of people have these diffusers that give off scented mists. They give off a lot of VOCs. If there's negative health consequences associated with exposures to those chemicals, to what extent are they offset by the positive impact, if that's having any positive impact on someone's mental well-being? If it's making someone feel less stressed, we know that has positive health effects. So it is a very complicated subject,
And I guess talking about those types of products, I guess there's a crossover between when something's a VOC and when something's a particulate. I mean, these products aerosolize something, and at some point they're a particulate, but they're also a VOC at the same time, often. You know, you've got chemicals bound with particles bound with, you know, it's a heady mix when you get down to the nitty gritty.
Yes. And the chemistry, the physics is complicated. And then it's, you know, utterly heterogeneous. What you choose to do in your home, your office, your school, if you had one, is going to be completely different to what I do in mine. And this is where, you know, it's this wonderful melting pot of human behavior, having, you know, sometimes unintended consequences. And I think it gets, you know, most serious when one person is making a choice that's actually affecting others. Like, we would not accept someone smoking in the same room as us. You know, when I was a kid, everyone was smoking in the pub. That's just, we're never going back there. But, you know, we do, you know, vaping is increasingly common. Lots of other things we choose to do affects the air that other people are breathing. And I think we have to sort of accept that and see good air quality behaviors as being part of being a good citizen, really, because when we look after the air around us, we're helping other people.
And I think it's Joseph Allen says, the guy from Harvard, your building manager probably has more of an impact on your health than your GP does over your lifetime, which is kind of strange thing to say. But when you actually break it apart, it's probably not untrue. The people that manage the spaces that you occupy through your lifetime will probably have more of an impact on your health than the fella in the local GP surgery. I think it's quite a bizarre thing to think about. Something else I wanted to mention was we didn't really get on when it comes to classrooms on why this is important for kids. There is at this stage some pretty good evidence that the quality of the air that our kids are exposed to impacts their learning and health outcomes, isn't there?
Yeah, so for health outcomes, there's definitely evidence that the impacts of poor air quality are more significant on children than they are on adults, for example. And that's because, you know, they are in a developmental stage, and that makes them inherently more vulnerable. And I think that's, within some forums, that's the right message to motivate things, you know, motivate positive changes through this health message. I think, as you say, education is in some forums, you know, a more appropriate mechanism, because health effects, they're often only realized after long periods. And it's hard for any one individual, it's impossible for any one individual to tie a specific health event to their air quality exposure. It's actually not impossible, is it? There's some very well-documented, very famous, tragic cases where that is true, but they're, you know, a handful around the world.
Maybe explain to people why that's the case, Henry, because it is... your exposure to a particular environment, the first questions that are raised are what underlying medical conditions you've got, what age are you, what was your journey to work or school like, what's your home life like, what's your socioeconomic status, what's your, you know, what genes are you carrying from previous generation? I mean, your health outcomes to a specific exposure is very difficult to draw a straight line from, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And I think, you know, so many things that you do in your life may be a contributing factor to the outcomes that you realize, and they can be both positive and negative. So you might not observe a negative outcome because you're offsetting it in some other you know, often relatively unconnected way. We've had two cases in the UK, one relating to outdoor air pollution and one relating to indoor air pollution, where the death of children has formerly been associated with poor air exposure to poor quality air. And I think, you know, outside of those, you know, rare and tragic cases, the health effects have to be observed at a very large statistical scale to be able to say that what are the likely effects of air quality on, you know, populations, or at least regions of the population.
But that's not the case necessarily with something like learning outcomes. We can be quite a bit more precise, can't we, that the environment that you're in is having a specific impact on performance, say.
Exactly. And what I like about it is, you know, telling people that something is bad for them can be scary with education, and it actually translates directly to productivity in the workplace. Same thing. With education, we're telling people it will be better if you improve your air quality. You will see your pupils being more alert. You will see pupils fulfilling their potential to a greater extent, you know, through their learning and what they go on to do. And so I think, you know, schools is a great example, because every teacher went into teaching to help children learn. And if you're telling them, if you improve the air quality, you're going to help your children learn that little bit better, that's just playing to their own, you know, existing motivation. And I think that's a really positive angle to come at things.
Yeah, and much like the workplace, hell, the amount of time and effort and resources that go in to squeeze fractions of a percent of improved performance out of spaces. And if you can improve outcomes by even conservatively 2, 5, 6% in a place, and all the people have to do in order to do that is just breathe, could there be an easier win? It's a slam dunk from a business case perspective. We often talk in workplace environments of this 330-300 rule, or that 90% of your costs as a business are tied to your people. So any impact on the performance of your people in the business far outweighs the kind of bottom line impacts that you can have by reducing energy by, say, 20%. And in an education setting, how much money is being poured into tweaking and squeezing performances out of classrooms, and you could have an impact by just getting the kids to breathe if you get it right.
Yeah, and I think it highlights that there are different routes to motivating the same end goal, not just in a single, you know, space like schools, but between, you know, different workspaces, there are different motivations. And, you know, productivity for workplaces is obviously key. I think, you know, I think we as a sort of community of engineers and scientists, we've spoken for so long about, oh, we must improve, energy efficiency and get, you know, good ventilation with, you know, low energy means. And that's absolutely true, like vital to make an impact on climate change. You know, the amount of energy we use in buildings is huge. It has to come down. But in terms of the motivation, it's no good, because companies are just like, well, you know, my energy bill is a fraction of my cost. So you save me, you know, a big chunk of a very small piece of my bills. If you tell them that you're going to get, you know, absenteeism down or increase productivity, staff are a massive part of their costs. And suddenly they listen and they do, you know, you reach the same end goal, but motivated in a completely different way. And I think we need to kind of find for each building typology what these motivations are and at what level, you know. So I think schools, for example, it has to be at a sort of ultimately a school, even classroom level. But if we're thinking about the NHS, what level should we be thinking? And I don't know the answer to that. And I think, you know, should it come right from the government or should it come from NHS trusts? But changes need to happen, definitely.
And I think we can learn an awful lot from other things that have happened in the past about how you engage at a national level to try and enact change. I mean, the reality, even if you take something as singular as schools, even within that vertical, there are so many stakeholders that can have an impact on an outcome. You've, as you say, you've got the kids who can get engaged. You've got a teacher who can get engaged at a classroom level. You may have a year head who can manage teachers more effectively if they have the data to understand that Mrs. B in classroom two, for some reason, is just constantly having poor air quality outcomes in her classroom. So there's a management piece there. You then have a head of school level management stakeholder to get buy-in from everybody, and boards of management and governors and so on that then have to fund and invest it, and all the way up to state and government level investment in the sector. So even something as vertical as education has an enormous number of stakeholders that actually need to be engaged to get a good outcome. And each of them will need slightly different presentation of that data and risk to understand how it fits within their worldview. So it's enormously complicated. What I wanted to do, Henry, if possible, is just bring it back to you for a bit. I'm fascinated to know how you ended up in the Faculty of Engineering and lecturing in fluid dynamics, because I think you have an unusual journey perhaps to where you've ended up. And as an aside for people, maybe an explanation of the link between fluid dynamics and ventilation, because it doesn't, in plain English, doesn't seem to make much sense. But I think once explained, it's quite an interesting perspective.
Yeah, so fluid dynamics is just about how liquids and gases move. And the key thing about liquids and gases, which is different to solids, is that they, they have an ability to more easily deform when you try and move them around. And so fluid dynamics cuts across all sorts of industrial and environmental processes, and of course, when we're thinking about cities and air quality, we're thinking about air quality moving around our city. That's just, the physics that moves it. We call that fluid dynamics. And that's exactly true when we come inside our buildings too. So you get some fascinating airflows in buildings that, we're always learning more about. And they actually... playing, understanding these kind of physics is important for air quality. You can get very easily have a lot of air passing through a space, but if the corner that you're sitting in, doesn't feel the effects of that air passing through the space, effectively the space you're in is very poorly ventilated, even though the room as a whole might be well ventilated. So you get these kind of dead zones, recirculating zones, forming in spaces. So we do need, at a very detailed level to keep understanding these better.
So it's a very broad area of learning then, fluid dynamics. To the layperson, I don't know what you imagine or what I imagine when I think of fluid dynamics, but I think of people sat doing CFD modelling and looking at air movements in space and stuff, but I guess it's an incredibly broad subject when you actually start breaking it apart.
Oh, Simon, my advice to you is get 2 pint glasses, fill one with, salty water, 5-10% of the glass salty water, salt, and then add water, mix it up, put it in a bottle, shake it. 2 pint glasses, one full of salt water, one full of fresh water, and put, 5 or 6 ice cubes in each, and watch what happens, which melts first, and think about it. And I think most people will be hooked on fluid dynamics after that.
Well, there's something for the listeners to go away and have a think about. And so where do they write to in Imperial College when they don't know the answer and want to go and learn?
Oh, just Google me.
So explain to us then your journey to Imperial College, because you did a bit of time at Cambridge. In fact, you were even in finance at some point, weren't you, Henry?
Yeah, so you asked about my journey, and I thought the one word that sprung to mind was convoluted. So I I originally did engineering as a first degree in Bristol, and then I did spend about 6 or 7 years in finance, and I enjoyed it, but I kind of accidentally fell into finance. I didn't really expect to get a job and all these sorts of things, and I knew it was never going to be a lifelong career, and I wanted to get back into engineering. So I tried to apply to all the grad schemes at all the big engineering firms, but I hadn't got an engineering degree in recent years. It was, you know, 6 years ago, 7 years ago by then. So I wasn't able to apply. So I thought a long time, you know, what to do, and ended up going back to do a PhD in fluid dynamics. Not unconnected actually to indoor airflows. And I went into the PhD thinking, you know, it was a sort of win-win in that if I didn't like research, I thought, you know, then I'll have a recent engineering degree and I can go back out into industry. If I like in research, I'll try and stay in it. And I loved research. And I've never looked back. And I think I moved from London to Cambridge and back to London again. And I've increasingly become, you know, I started as a very sort of applied physics person, I suppose. You know, I did very controlled laboratory experiments, and they have implications for indoor airflows, but I didn't just want to be an esoteric person doing experiments in a lab, and so I've increasingly tried to sort of work with operational spaces, think about, put the humans. Kath Noakes, very early in my career said, you know, what you do is great, but you should really be, you know, putting humans at the center of your engineering of buildings. And I think she's right. Like, we don't have buildings for the sake of buildings. We have buildings for the occupants. And so you have to think about things that way around, even if you are an engineer. And frankly, occupants are extremely inconvenient. They do lots of things that you don't predict they're going to do. And they change the way the building responds. They're based, you know, from what you had expected. So they're, you know, occupants are the real challenge.
Yeah, if all we had to do was build empty boxes, exactly. Engineering jobs would be really easy, you know, and much less risk involved. What kind of stuff are you working on now? I mean, obviously you've got Sammy, which is in the midst of it all. What kind of areas are you researching at the moment that's pushing your buttons?
So one that I think is really important, it's a particularly challenging one, is we think a lot about the interaction of air quality and the movement of heat and around our buildings, but we don't think very much about the heat transfer mechanism radiation. It's really complicated to put into models. But it's really, really important in terms of actually understanding how the air will move around our spaces. So that's, I think, a big research challenge that we're just starting to try and tackle. I do some work on cloud physics, which is quite interesting. And it's actually weirdly linked back to my original PhD work. It was all about sort of cold air coming up and falling back down, which we would call a fountain. And I think that the real challenge, I think, it's going to take, you know, a decade or so at least. We need to start building up more and more data and usable data on our indoor environments. You know, we've done quite a good job actually, particularly in the UK, on outdoor air for establishing, you know, big networks of sensors which which measure data. And that's why we've been able to you know, link, make these really important findings about the health effects of particulate matter. For example, we need to do a similar scale thing in buildings, but it's an order of magnitude more challenging. You know, you think about, just look out your window and you can think about the air you're seeing over quite a large space being relatively well connected to each other. And then look in the building that you're in, you know, the walls mean that, you know, the air concentration on one side of a wall can be very different concentrations on the other. And so we have this, and buildings are owned very differently to outdoor space. So there's all sorts of challenges that need to be overcome to really get the understanding that's needed about the importance of indoor air quality, and also to evidence the benefits. You know, it's this thing that if people are doing a good thing and they don't know they're doing a good thing, then they might stop. But if they're doing a good thing and you show them the evidence of the changes, the benefits that they're yielding because of their behaviors, they're going to continue. And that's really important.
And do you think some of that challenge in both the scale and size of the built environment, but also the scale and size of the research that's going on at the moment as well, that is that where your interest in things like an indoor air quality observatory comes from, that this need to try and start pulling some of this stuff together at a grander scale? I know I've been involved with you a couple of times now, looking at what they've done in France with the Observatory of Indoor Air Quality over there. Is that the kind of thing that's sparking your interest in air quality observatories?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I definitely share the motivation to gather this data. And I think the best way to do it is through some formal observatory. I think, you know, the French observatory was set up over 20 years ago. And I think the methods that are available to us now in terms of low-cost sensing and cloud storage of data, they are revolutionary compared to 20 years ago. So the methods are probably should be quite different. But I think
the scale of research, Henry, is much bigger as well than it was 20 years ago. I mean, the sheer scale of research into indoor air quality is orders of magnitude bigger than it was 20 years ago.
Well, absolutely right, Simon. And that's actually a risk, because, you know, at the moment, as a country and actually globally, there's a lot of investment in research around air quality measurements, where these measurements get made and they're used for a particular study. And then they're not, even if they are technically, you know, openly available, there's no centralized mechanism to do shared analysis and the like. And I think that needs to change. So, you know, now sitting at the core of the air quality observatory idea has to be that researchers, initially perhaps from all over the UK and let's hope globally at one stage, can put research data and ongoing data collection results into a repository, so we don't get siloed research where, you know, one group is looking at, you know, one group is looking from this perspective and has this data which is useful for their hypothesis, and another group has a different set of data to look at a different hypothesis. You know, we need to be bringing this data together so that all groups can look at the big data set and we'll reach more valid scientific conclusions at a much lower cost if we have this centralized system of sharing data. But it's really challenging because context is key, right? I mean, we can all chuck time series data of concentrations in cloud storage and access it, but it's meaningless unless we know, you know, where the monitor was, something about, you know, the space it was in, you know, how that space was being used ideally. These are real, real big challenges, but they're the sorts of challenges that I think we're at the right stage to really start tackling them. And I think it's difficult because it doesn't, these sorts of ideas do not fit into a typical funding mechanism for research in the UK. So I think the challenge is really getting things started and finding that money to support such an endeavour for a period that we can realise benefit from. And once we're realising benefit, then I think it will be much more self-sustaining.
And I don't know if it's already too late, but the importance to get something like this done early is that it's not just academia that is recording environmental data at scale now. Industry is doing the same thing. I was talking to Tyler Smith, who's the vice president of Johnson Controls Healthy Buildings there, a couple of weeks ago on the podcast. And the scale of data that a company like even Johnson Controls is capturing is such a missed opportunity if it's not coordinated in a way with other sets of data and bringing all of this understanding together, because we don't really even understand the boundary conditions of usefulness of this data because we're not seeing the true scale of it. It's hard to know how much context we need when we're not seeing the full scale of the big data that's available. And just as a simple example, even Johnson Controls internally as an organization is managing 100,000 staff across 2,000 buildings across six continents. The scale of data collection, even within their own buildings, would blow most academic studies out the water. So there's enormous opportunity here with something like an observatory to pull as much of this stuff together as early as we can. Otherwise, the risk potentially is we lose control of it altogether, that it moves completely outside of academic rigor, and we end up with all sorts of different ways of collecting data that makes it much more difficult to pull in a later stage. So I think it's a fascinating idea, the observatory. Have you any sense of how that might progress, what a next step might look like for an observatory in the UK?
I mean, I have ideas, and I'm trying to have conversations with the right sorts of people. It's got to come at some level from government. I would have thought at least some of the money would needs to come from research councils, but then there's lots of, you know, well, basically every government agency is affected by these things. So, you know, I think it either needs to come very centrally or from sort of all government channels. It's a conversation that it's the right time to have it now. You know, the chief medical officer devoted his 2022 annual report to air pollution, and he explicitly stated that indoor air pollution is an increasingly important part of the challenge, and that's true. An observatory would be a sort of recognition of this fact. And what would be nice is if we act now, the UK can take a lead in this. We don't, you know, we can show other countries, you know, how a modern indoor air quality observatory should be. And I expect that, you know, over the coming years, we wouldn't be the only one. I think there's so much interest around the world.
Yeah, really interesting. I mean, what's your hopes more broadly over the next 5 to 10 years for perhaps the indoor air quality community, academic community, but more broadly out in the built environment? If you were looking at this in 2028, where would you hope we'd be?
I think it's obvious we're going to have a lot more data I really hope that we've done a good job of managing and structuring and doing appropriate quality assurance on that data. Because if we do, then I think we should be in a place where we're much better informed, and we can link to, you know, other well-established communities, you know, healthcare professionals, you know, people who work on, you know, changing people's behaviours, people who look at, you know, educational and productivity outcomes. You know, the one thing we haven't talked about today that is really important is the impacts on, you know, psychological well-being, people's mental health. We know that people's environments are really important for their mental health. Mental health has been such a strong part of the COVID story. It had a really detrimental impact on so many people's mental well-being. And we need to recover from that, we as, you know, a society. And I think that better understandings of the links between indoor environments and mental health is a really important one that there's not much been done on it. And I think it is one of those ones that would be well addressed by, you know, large scale data sets.
Yeah, very interesting. And what a fabulously well resourced sector to do resource in, mental health. He says somewhat ironically. But incredibly important to do. You're absolutely right. And it also speaks more broadly to the general framing of this stuff, that we need to get better at communicating and talking about air quality. It's one of the things I've been very cognizant to try and do in these podcasts, is to keep things very plain English. We can make air quality sound quite complex and frightening sometimes, because it is complex and nuanced. There's no getting away from that, but actually often the routes to improving it are founded on very well known and well trodden paths of hierarchies of control and managing spaces. Often the solutions aren't that complex, are they, Henry? Although understanding this chemistry and this physics and this fluid dynamics is complex, often the things we need to do to get a better outcome aren't.
Absolutely, yeah. I guess you can look at it in a number of ways. The one is to say we're actually starting from quite a low bar. I mean, you know, a lot of our indoor spaces are not well conditioned at the moment. And you're right. In those cases, there's often really simple things that can be done that would have dramatic impacts on those environments. So, absolutely.
Henry, thanks so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure to talk to you as always. It'd be great to have you on again sometime, particularly to get an update on Sammy and how it's gone. I think lots of people will be interested to see how that project finally finishes up. So thanks very much for your time. We'll speak again soon.
I look forward to it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a million.